Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Although the United States incarceration rate has gone down slightly, and we incarcerate about 100,000 people less than our 2008 peak of 2.3 million people, the U.S. still incarcerates a higher percentage of its population than any other country in the world. In fact, we hold 22% of the world's prisoners. That's one in five. My guest today wanted to get an inside look at how our prison system works today, especially our private for-profit prison system. So he got a job as a guard. Shane Bauer is no stranger to prisons. The senior reporter for Mother Jones magazine spent over 2 years in Iran's infamous Evin prison when he strayed across the border in 2009 while on a weekend excursion while working in Kurdistan. After being released in 2011, he began thinking about how we treat our imprisoned. While working as a guard in a private prison in Winfield, Louisiana, he saw firsthand how legitimate inmate needs, food, housing, and basic medical treatment are inadequate. He also saw how the system works from the other side, underpaid, understaffed, and overworked guards who deal with constant turnover and how that affects the prison population as well. His award-winning Mother Jones article on his experiences is now the basis for his book, American Prison, A Reporter's Undercover Journey into the Business of Punishment. It's published by Penguin. Shane Bauer, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You've written that when we look back at this time, maybe a century from now, our prison system will be one of the defining factors of this age. Why do you say that will be one of the defining factors?
I mean, we're really at an unprecedented time in world history. We have more people in prison in this country than anywhere in the world. We have over 2 million people in prison, and we're kind of, it's in some ways an invisible problem. It's becoming more visible, but this affects the entire society. I mean, we have people all around us who have been through this prison system. And I think that when we look back on this time, it's going to be one of the kind of great shames of our era.
In fact, we're incarcerating more people than ever. And I think, what is it, a quarter of the world's population of incarcerated population is here in the United States now?
That's right. And most of us don't understand this history, but this prison system that we have is a direct outgrowth in many ways of slavery. This is one of the things I really dig into in my book, the ways that prisons were really, penitentiaries were invented in this country, and from the very beginning they were driven by a kind of profit motive, using captive people for forced labor. And prisons in the South really, in some ways, replaced the role of slavery. Prisoners were put to work on plantations. They were whipped for not picking enough cotton or mining enough coal. They were dying at rates much higher than enslaved people were dying at. We're talking 16% to 25% per year death rate. This is on par with the Soviet gulags. And, you know, this kind of period of convict leasing grew into a state-run period that was almost identical, where states were running their own plantations at a profit. And this kind of grew into our modern private prison system. It also directly grew into our modern private prison system. The man who founded the Corrections Corporation of America started his career running a cotton plantation, prison plantation in Texas. He lived on a plantation with his family. They had what were called houseboys. This is in 1967. And he was later running prison plantations in Arkansas at a profit to the state. And he did such a good job that he attracted the interest of businessmen who proposed the idea to him that, you know, they start a kind of the latest chapter, essentially, of for-profit prisons by founding the Corrections Corporation of America that would be traded on the New York Stock Exchange.
In fact, I was really shocked. You write of a trip by Winthrop Rockefeller, then the governor of Arkansas, into one of his prisons, and literally his protective detail had to hand over their guns to inmate guards because he had the inmates, I guess the toughest inmates, became the trustees who actually were in charge of policing other inmates.
Yeah, this was common for decades, that states would run their, when they bought plantations and turn them into prisons, one of the ways that they saved money was to not hire guards and instead give guns to select inmates. They were typically inmates who were convicted of the most brutal crimes because they could be trusted to shoot somebody who was trying to escape. And in Arkansas, if one of these inmate trustees shot and killed an inmate attempting to escape, the governor would grant him an automatic parole. Arkansas did not ban the whip until 1967. So wow. There were also inmates that were acting as overseers on the plantation, torturing people who weren't picking cotton fast enough.
So the idea of rehabilitation within our penitentiary system and prison system is pretty a short-lived idea, really, in the history of corrections in the United States.
It is. I mean, the idea of the penitentiary when it started was, you know, at the time people were being punished through capital punishment for things like theft. You know, someone might be hanged for theft. And the idea of the penitentiary was, okay, we can stop killing people for these kind of crimes and instead put them for a period of time in prison. And the idea was they would be rehabilitated through labor. And just really 2 and 3 decades into the kind of existence of this penitentiary system in the Northeast, many states were debating whether to abolish penitentiaries. Many people were saying it was a failed experiment, that people were not being rehabilitated. The crime rates were, in fact, rising. And what essentially saved, one of the things that saved the penitentiary system was that in New York, in the Auburn State Penitentiary, a captain kind of took over the penitentiary, and he vowed to turn prisoners who had been notorious for rioting and burning down wings of the prison. He promised to turn them into what he called insulated, silent working machines. And he convinced the state to reinstate the whip, which had been banned by the American Revolution. He contracted their labor to private contractors, and the prison started making a profit. So rather than getting rid of their penitentiaries, other states copied this model, and states throughout the Northeast were opening penitentiaries that were actually adding money into their treasuries. So it almost didn't matter at that point whether rehabilitation was working because it had become a profitable venture. And in the decades after the Civil War, it was so profitable, not just to private companies, but to states. Alabama was making 10% of its budget through leasing of prison labor.
Wow. You have a document in the book, and you allude to it. It's a document of how the state of Texas, the money they were making from sending their prisoners out to pick cotton. And it was not an insubstantial amount of money even in those days.
Right. That was 1965.
Yeah.
And around that time, it's the 60s and 70s, in the 70s, we started to go through just a major boom in the prison population. That really kind of changed this system in a lot of ways, where there were too many prisoners to be kind of using them on labor camps, and states were just put in the situation where they had to build prisons. They couldn't build them fast enough, which is what kind of gave a window for companies like the Corrections Corporation of America to step in and say, you know, we'll build prisons and we'll run them for you at a lower cost.
And along with that, I think at least at the beginning, in a place like Wynn where you worked, it was about the idea of working inmates again. But even that, as the profit motive became more important and the margins went down as state aid declined for private prisons, that went out the window as well.
Yeah, and now we've kind of gone from the southern system of prisons being essentially labor camps to what we have today, which is more like kind of human warehouses where people are just held in cells or dorms, and most of them have nothing to do, and they just kind of spend the years, you know, just kind of wasting away.
Now, you decided to go undercover at Wynn Prison, which is run by CCA, or was run by CCA at the time you were there. You know, what made you decide to do this? Your background, you know, you're a reporter, you had been a prisoner held in Iran, accused of espionage from 2009 to 2011, in what most of us would refer to as a notorious prison, Iran's Evin prison. Why did you decide to go undercover and go back to a prison? I think it would be the last place anybody would want to go.
Well, when I got out of prison in Iran in 2011, I came home you know, I'd assumed that eventually I would go back to the Middle East. The Arab Spring was well underway at that point. But when I got home, I happened to get home in California at a time that there was a huge hunger strike happening in California prisons. There were reports of 30,000 inmates at one point hunger striking to protest the use of long-term solitary confinement. I had been in solitary confinement myself. I know the torture of solitary confinement. I had been 4 months in solitary, and I found that there were people in California in solitary confinement for 10, 20, 30, and even 40 years.
Wow.
So, you know, when I was ready to kind of go back to work, I dug into this. And from there, I just kind of kept getting pulled deeper and deeper into our prison system and our criminal justice system. And I spent a few years reporting on these topics and was constantly frustrated by the lack of access to prisons. It's very difficult to get access to prisons in this country, and it's become more difficult over the years. And this is especially true for for-profit prisons, where even public records laws often don't apply because these are private companies. So, you know, I had the idea of just applying for a job and seeing if I could get inside that way. It was somewhat of a whim. I honestly didn't really think it was going to work, but I thought, you know, give it a try. So I filled out an application on the corporate website. I didn't lie in the application. I put my real name, my personal information, my job history. And within a couple of weeks, I was getting phone calls for job interviews. And, you know, they didn't ask me anything about my job history in these interviews or why I wanted to work in a prison. It was more like they were trying to convince me to take the job. You know, I eventually took a job for $9 an hour in Louisiana.
Yeah, and I think the main selling point was you were living right next to a national forest so you could go fishing and hunting.
Right, right.
That sounds very typical for our part of the country. But they never asked that you were a reporter, and you used your real name, so any serious background mm-hmm. check would have found that you had been writing stories about prisons in the United States, right?
Yeah, and there was no indication that they read my application. They didn't ask me anything about my application or what I'd written in it.
Talk about a little bit the transformation you had to go from, because your only experience with a correctional system was being a prisoner, and all of a sudden you're now a guard.
Yeah, I mean, when I started the job, I kind of thought I'll just be an easygoing guard, laid back, you know, and it should be pretty smooth. But it was much more complicated than that. I initially had to grapple with the fact that I was on the other side, that, you know, I was, I found a cell phone once and took a cell phone from a prisoner, which, you know, I would have died for when I was a prisoner. You know, and these prisoners, it was a different situation, obviously. This was not a political prison. But still, there is a certain kind of sympathy that you have once you've been locked up for other people who are locked up and their attempts to gain little bits of freedom. And, you know, I would feel guilty about things, about punishing people. And very quickly, I realized that I needed to just kind of turn that part of myself off. And once I did that, the job became much easier. I became kind of numb and more authoritarian. And, you know, just kind of did essentially what they tell us to do, which is not to differentiate between prisoners and kind of treat them all the same. And I think that's kind of essential if your job is to lock people up day after day. And I saw that with other, you know, cadets that I went through training with. They had a similar process, or they would just not be able to do it and they would quit.
My guest today is Shane Bauer. He's a senior reporter for Mother Jones magazine. Wrote an article about what would become the book, American Prison, A Reporter's Undercover Journey into the Business of Punishment. It's published by Penguin. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, as you were going through the training, there's a lot of time in the book spent talking about the training, because the training tells you one thing, your time in the yard, in the tiers, as they refer to it, WIN, were completely different.
Yeah, yeah. Training, you know, was mostly in a classroom. We would just kind of watch videos. There were days that the prison was so understaffed that they couldn't have anybody to train us. So we would just sit there essentially twiddling our thumbs. And they told us in training, early in training, that part of our job was to deliver value to our shareholders. And this theme would kind of come up in various ways. And one of them was essentially around liability to the company, that, you know, we were kind of meant to do the minimum required to protect us from lawsuits. On my second day of training, we were an instructor asked us hypothetically what we would do if we saw two inmates fighting. And, you know, a cadet says, maybe I'd call somebody. Somebody says, break them up. And he said, our job was to shout, stop fighting, just to shout that. And we were not to get in the middle of them. He said, we're not going to pay you that much. And what's important is that we go home at the end of the day. And he said, if them fools want to cut each other, then happy cutting. You know, so the idea is that, you know, if we just shout at them, we're doing our job as guards, but getting in the middle of them, you know, we could get hurt. We don't have any weapons, and, you know, that would cost the company more money.
And what you saw as you went to becoming a full-fledged CO, correctional officer, mm-hmm. through your training, pointed up the profit motive that's involved in a private prison. You see facilities which were designed for a lot more correctional officers, guard towers, unmanned, because that was a cost-cutting move, medical treatment denied, privileges denied on whims, again, as cost-cutting moves, gates not manned, cost-cutting moves. Can you give us a sense of how shallow this organization was being run to produce profit for the corporation?
Yeah, the prison held about 1,500 inmates. There were days that there would be 24, 25 guards on a shift. There were medical was a major issue. I met a man who lost his legs and fingers to gangrene. He had been begging for months for medical attention for severe pain that was so bad that he couldn't sleep. And they would just give him some Motrin and send him back. And I saw a man collapse from heart pain that was asking of the hospital that was denied. And, you know, the issue is that if the company, by its contract, if it sends a prisoner to a hospital, it has to foot the bill, you know, so it's very reluctant to do that. Prisoners who were suicidal would be put on suicide watch, essentially a cell that they're kept in, which was expensive to run for the company because a guard would have to sit and watch a single prisoner. So rather than one guard for 175 prisoners, it was one guard for one prisoner. And they tried to discourage people from going there by, and this is what I was literally told in training, by offering worse food to the prisoners. Prisoners who were suicidal and on suicide watch would be given food that did not meet USDA standards for the required number of calories. And if somebody stayed on suicide watch for more than 48 hours, they had to call the regional corporate office to get permission to keep them longer. You know, so there was just over and over, you kind of saw this theme repeating itself where, you know, the decisions are reduced to how much they cost.
And what you also found was just the sheer orderly processes of holding 1,250 men together in a single facility were being basically stretched to the limits and really beyond the limits by the number of cuts. You describe a unit, I think it was a segregation unit, where you're coming in the evening and they're just now getting lunch because right. of just breakdowns in the ability of the organization to run in any sort of not even efficient manner, but, you know, the bare minimum.
Yeah, I mean, this is a constant. Every day there was some new crisis, and it was like you would come into work and you just wouldn't know where it's going to manifest itself that day. But it could be that the meals were way behind because there wasn't enough staff. It could be that classes are canceled because there's not enough staff. Recreation is canceled because there's not enough staff. Some days the staff was so low that they would lock down the entire prison. So the prison would not function. You know, people would not leave their dorms, the prisoners. And, you know, this led to an environment that was highly toxic. And prisoners were constantly frustrated. Guards were constantly frustrated. You would see guards and prisoners sometimes bonding over their disdain for the company. And tensions would ratchet up throughout the day over these frustrations, and people would explode. And men are, you know, cooped in a dorm for 44 men all day long. You know, violent situations erupt. Prisoners lash out at guards. Guards who are making $9 an hour just will neglect to do their duties because they know they won't be fired, and they feel no motivation to do what they're meant to do because, you know, they're just going to be kind of coming to confrontation with prisoners, and it's just not worth it to them. So people are kind of coming in just clocking in and clocking out.
Well, there was one moment when there was at least some motivation from the top, and that was when Louisiana's Department of Corrections was threatening to pull the contract.
Right. Yeah, the prison had become so chaotic that the company was trying to pull the contract. And so I happened to be there at a time when the company was desperate to hold on to the prison, and they tried to kind of turn it around. They sent in a kind of tactical team called the SORT team from prisons, CCA prisons around the country, and they would, you know, shake down the prison, trying to find weapons. They kind of ran a regiment of brute force. They would, you know, gas inmates, pepper spray them, and then the state took over the prison at one point for about a week and sent in, you know, officers and wardens from public prisons and kind of, you know, got the prison running in a different way. The prisoners automatically reacted to them differently than they do to the private prison guards. They take them more seriously. But, you know, as soon as they left, it just slid back into kind of the situation that it was in before they came.
I want to ask about two incidents that I thought was very telling. The first was pretty early in your stay when you were still a probationary officer, and you were required to get a prisoner out of his cell, I think, in restraint to go someplace. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, instinctively a prisoner will sort of push back against a person leading him. And he said, all of a sudden, mm-hmm. I says, you know, you flash back to your time in Iran when you did right. The same thing. What was that feeling like?
Mm-hmm. Being the guard in that situation?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, as a prisoner, there was this kind of, it's almost just a matter of dignity to, you know, a guard is kind of escorting you with his hand on your arm. You know, I would maybe slow down a little bit or, you know, just kind of offer a little bit of resistance. And when I was a guard and feeling that, you know, I was walking this prisoner and he said, you know, stop pushing me, stop pushing me. And, you know, in my mind, I'm thinking, I'm not pushing this guy. I'm just walking him. But even though I could understand in my mind his motive, it still felt like a personal attack. And this was something I felt all of the time where, you know, I could, I was very critical of the prison and how it was run and could understand the frustrations of prisoners. You still kind of get into situations that feel very personal. And I would have somebody lashing out at me. And so I would develop almost vendettas against individual people. And there was just really a disconnect between this kind of, you know, larger, almost abstract understanding of maybe where people are coming from and a more visceral kind of reactive place that I was in quite a bit in the prison, just because it was so intense. And I was sometimes just worried about my own safety.
It's probably easy for people who have no connection to the prison system to come up with stereotypes about the type of people who become prison guards. What were your expectations, and were they what you expected or something different from the people who do take the job? At $9 an hour, it sounds almost like a job of last resort for a lot of them.
Yeah, that was one of the things that really, you know, was eye-opening for me. Having been a prisoner, prison guard is one of the kind of worst people you can think of. It's the person that locks you up every day. And when I went to Wynn, I realized that the guards in this, particularly in this for-profit system, were also being exploited very much by the system. It was not only prisoners. These were not people who were sadists that, you know, wanted to be a prison guard so they could torment prisoners. These were just people that had very little options in life. And so they were so desperate that they were willing to work in a prison for $9 an hour. There were, you know, a really surprising number of single moms who were prison guards. There were retirees who were trying to supplement their pensions. And there was a small portion of guards who were particularly brutal and had been pushed out of other areas of law enforcement because of their behavior. There was a man who had worked in a juvenile detention center in Texas who left his job after he uppercutted a 16-year-old boy and shattered his jaw. Hmm. You know, so you have these kind of people who are not going to be able to get jobs in the field anymore, but the private prison company will hire them. They have experience. They will take those lower-paying jobs because they, you know, they're not going to get a job anywhere else.
Well, we have just a moment left. I want to ask you, after your time at Wynn, and you've written about this, we saw after your article came out that the Obama administration basically decided not to renew contracts with private prisons in the federal system. That changed just as soon as the new administration changed. What are the first steps we can take to reform the way we house people who break the law that we feel need to be incarcerated?
I mean, I think ending private prisons is an obvious measure, and I don't think that is actually controversial. You know, we saw, like you mentioned, that it happened, although it was reversed. But this is really just kind of the tip of the iceberg, and there is not a quick fix. You know, the core of the problem is mass incarceration, that we have more than 2 million people behind bars in this country. And there's no way for us to house that many people in prison in a humane way that has anything to do with rehabilitation. So tackling that problem, you know, means dealing with mandatory minimum sentencing, addressing just the length of how many years we're putting people in prison for. It has to do with the power of prosecutors, which has become much stronger over the years. It has to do with policing. It has to do with racism in American society. It has to do with economic inequality. I mean, prison is kind of like the sign of many of the illnesses that exist in society. It's the last step. So if we want to talk about prison reform, you know, we really need to be addressing all the stages before somebody gets to a prison.
All right. The name of the book is American Prison. Shane, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Shane Bauer is a senior reporter for Mother Jones Magazine, and he is the author of American Prison, A Reporter's Undercover Journey into the Business of Punishment, which he wrote after spending 4 months undercover as a prison guard in a private prison in Louisiana. It's published by Penguin Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.